from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The U.S. is sending arms to Iraq to suppress the insurgency there that American officials claim is backed by Al-Qaeda. According to the New York Times, the U.S. is rushing dozens of missiles and surveillance drones to help Iraqi forces combat the insurgency against the government installed during the U.S. occupation of that country. While whistleblower Edward Snowden sparked a global debate on mass spying, he's actually a private person who does not seek attention for himself. This according to Washington Post reporter Barton Gellman in an exclusive interview with RT. Gellman was the first reporter to interview Snowden after the former NSA contractor was granted temporary asylum in Russia. Snowden and Gellman spoke for about 14 hours over 2 days. Gellman says Snowden talked about the reasons behind his whistleblowing, but did not otherwise talk much about his private life. However, in his interview with RT, Gellman shared his personal impression of the current state of mind of the man who some call the most wanted man on earth.
Well, you were with him for 2 days, which is a pretty extensive amount of time, 14 hours of conversation. How would you describe Edward Snowden right now? I mean, just in terms of sort of his demeanor and his mentality.
He is remarkably sort of at peace with everything. He's a man under considerable pressure, I must assume, but he doesn't show it. He's feeling like he did what he set out to do. When he says that he's accomplished his mission, what he means is that he's taken a very important subject out of a secret world and handed it to the public so that the people can decide for themselves where they want to draw the lines instead of having the lines drawn for them.
Mm-hmm. And in the article, you mentioned that when interviewing him, his guard never really dropped, which I thought was interesting, considering you're saying that he was remarkably calm and whatnot. Did you get the sense that he was sort of constantly worrying or concerned at all about his future, which is basically unknown at this point?
He doesn't project concern about his future. He is. What I mean by that he didn't drop his guard is that he has boundaries. For one thing, he's a very private person. He understands that he is in the news, that he has done something very much newsworthy. He wants the news to be about the policy, the subject, the documents themselves. He doesn't see that he's got any obligation to talk about his personal life. And he has natural security concerns. And so he pays attention to what he says.
It's interesting that such a private person is now so much in the open in the public right now. But can you talk about how you prepared for this trip? Did you have to leave your laptop, your cell phone at all? I mean, were there tons of precautions that you had to take before going over there?
I can say a little bit about that. I mean, I did not bring anything with me that I was not prepared to have one or another government take hold of and search or keep or copy. So, I didn't bring anything sensitive. I brought an empty notebook computer and I brought a telephone I don't normally use with none of my data on it.
Right.
And as far as I know, those precautions were superfluous in the end because no one stopped me.
And have you had any issues since you've returned? Have you been approached at all by anybody asking you questions, interrogating you?
No, nothing
of that sort.
No interrogations, no.
Okay, then that means that you prepared well. Well, one of the things that I found most interesting is something that Edward Snowden said. He said, "I'm not trying to bring down the NSA. I'm working to improve the NSA. I'm still working for the NSA right now. They are the only ones who don't realize it." Did Snowden have anything to say about the current reform efforts underway on Capitol Hill or the courts or anything of that nature?
Well, it's interesting. He clearly has his own views about what ought to happen. What he most wants to make sure is that there can be an open debate about them with full knowledge. So it was all in a secret court. It was in a very small committee of Congress. For example, members of Congress rely on their staffs. There may be 1 in 10 members of Congress has a staffer who is cleared for material at the level of secrecy that this stuff was kept. So most of them didn't understand very much about what was going on. We spoke just before a very big week for him that vindicated many of his assertions. I mean, he has said all along he believes that some of the programs at the NSA are illegal. Well, soon after we spoke, a federal judge, the first one to consider it in open court, says that one of the main programs of the NSA is unconstitutional, or almost certainly unconstitutional. The president's own review board comes back with many reform proposals. The leaders of the U.S. technology industry come and tell the president in person that the NSA's actions are harming the information economy. So he got a lot of validation in really the last working week of the year.
Absolutely. Were you able to talk to him at least through the keyboard about those developments?
Well, you know, I'm not going to add anything here to what I've already published,
okay.
But I would say that you know, sort of that he and his circles are pleased with what's
okay,
been going
okay.
on.
Okay, that's not very surprising. Well, Snowden was insistent that he would never want to publish these leaks all at once. That would be, quote, suicide watch. Can you explain a little bit what he meant by that?
It's not. He opposes publication, you know, dumping all the documents out. Not only all at once. He doesn't want me to publish everything that I have. He wants me to use my own judgment about what is newsworthy and what would do harm. So it's not only he doesn't want it all at once, he doesn't necessarily want it all published in the first place. What he's talking about with suicide is this. There are people who claim that he has some other cache of material that he's got rigged up to a dead man's switch so that if he doesn't keep checking in, something bad happens to him, then he unleashes this whole thing on the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, first of all, there's no evidence for that. It's contrary to what he says he wants. But he said, just look at it logically. If I have rigged up a dead man's switch, and then I may as well just, you know, basically ask everyone to shoot me, because any service in the world that really wants to see this stuff go public, all they have to do is get rid of me. So it's illogical. He said it's not a dead man switch, it's a suicide switch.
Absolutely. And you mentioned you having this material and you having to make the decision of what gets released and when. How is it a concerted effort? How are you making these decisions?
I am reviewing material. I am reviewing it with a very small number of trusted colleagues. I'm doing reporting around it. I mean, a lot of it is in the form of clues. There might be, you know, one line in each of, you know, 16 documents that makes me think that there's something going on or something of interest. I check it out. I talk to government officials. I talk to people in industry. Sometimes I'm persuaded that my idea was wrong. Sometimes I'm persuaded by government that it would be a bad idea to publish the story. But most often we find something that we think is interesting and of public import. And in consultation with my editors at the Post, we publish.
And lastly, you know, The Guardian was threatened by the UK government and forced to destroy the copies on their server. And I was wondering if that's ever been an issue for you or the Washington Post. I mean, how have you been able to maintain these documents and really protect them?
If there had been threats or coercion used against me or the Washington Post, you would know it. That would be news, and we would be the first to report it. There has been no attempt by the U.S. government to compel us to do anything. There have been times when they've asked us, they've tried to persuade us not to publish something. There are times we've agreed, times we haven't. To the rest of your question, we're taking very considerable steps to keep the material safe.
Snowden himself delivered what he called an alternative Christmas message on British TV yesterday. In his pre-recorded address, the whistleblower called for an end to mass spying by governments, saying that a child born today would have no conception of privacy. The recording was made in Russia, where Snowden has lived since being granted temporary asylum in August. It was the first TV appearance he's made since he arrived in Moscow.
Hi, and Merry Christmas. I'm honored to have a chance to speak with you and your family this year. Recently, we learned that our governments, working in concert, have created a system of worldwide mass surveillance, watching everything we do. Great Britain's George Orwell warned us of the danger of this kind of information. The types of collection in the book, microphones and video cameras, TVs that watch us, are nothing compared to what we have available today. We have sensors in our pockets that track us everywhere we go. Think about what this means for the privacy of the average person. A child born today will grow up with no conception of privacy at all. they'll never know what it means to have a private moment to themselves, an unrecorded, unanalyzed thought. And that's a problem, because privacy matters. Privacy is what allows us to determine who we are and who we want to be. The conversation occurring today will determine the amount of trust we can place both in the technology that surrounds us and the government that regulates it. Together, we can find a better balance, end mass surveillance, and remind the government that if it really wants to know how we feel, asking is always cheaper than spying. For everyone out there listening, thank you and Merry Christmas.
That was Edward Snowden speaking yesterday from Moscow. On Tuesday, marked by millions in the U.S. and elsewhere as Christmas Eve, the American ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, called for additional troops to be sent into the Central African Republic. Although the conflict is being characterized in the West as a fight driven by hostilities between Muslims and Christians, these tensions only appeared recently as the U.S. presence in Africa has escalated and France has undertaken the project of reclaiming its former colonies on the continent. Don Bob reports from the United Nations.
There's a risk of people taking matters into their own hands in the Central African Republic, where atrocities continue to be committed as intercommunal violence rages. The warning comes from Ambassador Samantha Power, the permanent representative of the United States to the United Nations, who recently returned from a visit to the African country. She says even as the international community grapples with other crises, it should not lose sight of the situation in the Central African Republic.
The situation in CAR begs the world's attention. Terrible atrocities have occurred. Terrible atrocities are occurring. We met with one woman whose husband had been stabbed in front of her, his body then doused in gasoline and then set on fire in front of her very eyes. Part of what those who have survived violence of this nature are crying out for is justice. And one of the worries that we came away from the Central African Republic with was that those who are not seeing justice be done are increasingly tempted to take matters into their own hands.
Ambassador Power, who spoke to reporters late on Monday, says there's already a cycle of retribution and violence that is very alarming. On the positive side, she adds, almost everyone with whom she spoke during her mission to the Central African Republic said that the country has had for a long time a tradition of religious coexistence and religious harmony.
Late Tuesday, the UN did approve the additional forces Power insisted were needed to stop the fighting.
The UN Security Council has decided to reinforce the UN mission in South Sudan, UNMISS, as ethnic clashes displace thousands of people in the new country. In a resolution unanimously adopted on Tuesday afternoon, the council decided to increase the strength of UNMISS from its current over 6,800 troops and police to more than 12,000 peacekeepers. The decision follows a request by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who said he is determined to ensure that UNMISS has the means to protect civilians. Mr. Ban addressed the council following its decision.
Let me begin by thanking the Security Council for its action and engagement to address the mounting crisis in South Sudan. We are all deeply troubled by the events that have unfolded in recent days. There are reports of ethnically targeted violence, including extrajudicial killings and mass graves. The displacement of civilians is growing and spreading, with some 45,000 people seeking protection at the basis of the United Nations mission in South Sudan, UNMISS.
The Security Council calls on the warring parties in South Sudan to immediately stop fighting and start a dialogue. It also demands that they cooperate fully with UNMISS as it implements its mandate, in particular the protection of civilians. The Council stresses that efforts to undermine the ability of UNMISS to implement its mandate and attacks on United Nations personnel will not be tolerated. Don Bob, United Nations.
Meanwhile, in South Sudan, President Salva Kiir started talks to resolve the violence there with the leaders of Kenya and Ethiopia. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and Ethiopian Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn are in South Sudan's capital, Juba, to try to mediate a resolution to the conflict, during which hundreds of people have been killed over the past few days. Notably missing, however, was Kiir's rival, former Vice President Riek Machar, who has not been invited to take part in the talks. Machar has been in hiding since his rebel forces captured oil-producing regions along the border with Sudan. Speaking from an undisclosed location, Machar told the local newspaper, Sudan Tribune, he was ready to initiate a dialogue with Kiir, who fired him from his government post in July. Mashar said the talks must take place in a neutral location and suggested the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. He also submitted a list of delegates to a group of East African mediators. At least 92,500 people have been displaced since the conflict began December 15th, while some 58,000 have sought shelter at UN bases throughout the country. An inner-city land grab of national scope that seems headed towards a corporate urban feudalism is well underway in the United States. The culmination of processes that began during the Carter administration in the late 1970s and reached new heights in the real estate collapse of 2007 and 2008, which saw the loss of the bulk of the equity formerly held by working-class and middle-class homeowners here in the U.S., is now taking a new direction, direct concentration of the ownership of housing in the hands of Wall Street. Glenn Ford from BlackAgendaReport.com has more.
For more than a year, a small group of corporations has been scouring America's cities, buying up foreclosed family homes and turning them into rental properties on an unprecedented scale. Journalist Laura Gottsdiener has been on top of the story. She reports that the land-grabbing companies have been spending at the fantastic rate of $100 million a week, buying up thousands of properties at a time. Gottsdiener says the corporations are behaving like land pirates.
Yeah, making out like bandits is right. What we're talking about is really a housing crisis 2.0. So we're seeing pretty much the cousin companies or the sister companies of all the big banks, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Deutsche Bank, all of the big banks that crashed our economy in the first place. Now what they're doing, the cousin companies of these banks, essentially are executing a massive land grab. Private equity firms and hedge funds buying up cheap foreclosed properties, cheap foreclosed homes that families used to live in all over the country. And there's really no other way to think about it except that it is a land grab. And once again, Wall Street is controlling wide swaths of American life.
And one of the most prominent cousin companies that you speak of is Blackstone, which is buying up huge swaths of property in cities.
Exactly. So the Blackstone Group is the biggest culprit in this game. It's not the only one. There's American Homes for Rent. There's Colony Capital. There's a few others. But the Blackstone Group is really, it's extraordinary how much they've bought up in just the last year and a half. So from, you know, 2 years ago, they really didn't own any single-family homes. Today, they're the largest owner of single-family homes in the country. And this empire is the biggest one that's ever been amassed throughout U.S. history. So they own approximately 40,000 homes in, you know, about 14 cities across the country.
And in one day, you write, they bought 14,000 houses in Atlanta alone.
Yeah, it's staggering. So the thing that's really important to understand is that it's not like Blackstone Group has the same capacities as any individual family to buy up a house. No, this is a multi-billion dollar company that has enjoyed, you know, a $3.6 billion credit line just to buy up these houses. And what's worse is they don't even need to necessarily go to the auctions or buy individual homes like ordinary people do. So they pretty much buy these houses in bulk from the banks in the same way that an ordinary family might go to Costco and stock up on toilet paper.
And we're talking about billions of dollars worth of homes and transactions that are carried out in cash. With this kind of money power, they actually can enter a city and set the terms and shape the market for housing.
Exactly. So what we're seeing is, you know, and it's really amazing to me that we don't talk about it more. When we talk about home prices rising, what we're really talking about is Blackstone and these other companies going into markets, buying up so many homes so quickly that they push the prices of the houses up in that market, sometimes up to, you know, 20 or even 30% over the course of a year. And that's a shock to local markets. And what it means down the line is not only are they controlling the home prices in these cities, they're pushing them up, But down the line, it's very likely that they'll be able to price fix the rental rates as well in these cities. You know, and I was actually just on a radio show down in Florida, and a real estate agent called in and said, listen, there's some areas of our city where Blackstone and these other companies own so many of the houses that they essentially just decide whatever the rental rate is going to be in our city. So they've already started to, you know, he shied away from using the word price fix, but seems to me that it's a classic example of price fixing, cornering a market and then setting the rate.
Yes, many people anticipated that as one fallout of the housing debacle, at least the price of housing and rentals for housing might become more affordable. But with the intervention of big capital in such a big way, that's not happening.
Not happening at all. You know, just a few weeks ago, the president of HUD went on the press conference a few Mondays ago and said that we're in the worst rental affordability crisis that this country has ever seen. Not in the last 5 years, not since the Great Depression, but ever in the history of this country, we are facing the worst rental affordability crisis. Now, 7 years after the housing market collapsed. So if you think about families losing such a staggering amount of wealth, communities losing such a staggering amount of wealth, and now we're having rental affordability crises, it's getting really incredibly difficult and precarious just to simply live in this country. And that's why, you know, not only do I do these investigations, but I try to be quite clear that underlying problems like the Blackstone Group is a broader problem about how we think about housing and how we define housing in this country. And until we move closer to a human rights framework for housing, until we say housing is a human right, it's a human need, we need to revamp our housing market such that everybody is able to have a place to live, we're just going to see that it's going to get harder and harder and more expensive to live in this country.
It's interesting that you call these cousin companies, and they seem to be acting in concert with their big cousins, the ones who caused the collapse of the housing market back in 2007, 2008, that they are now performing the job of shoring up the assets of those same companies.
Exactly. So, you know, everyone's really working together on this one. It's clear and it's important to say that Blackstone is not a bank, a Wall Street bank, in the way that J.P. Morgan Chase is a Wall Street bank. But when you start to actually trace the money and see who profits from this type of shenanigans, you see that it is all the Wall Street banks and that these two types of entities really just work together. So, for example, you know, Blackstone has partnered with Deutsche Bank and with J.P. Morgan Chase to develop a security called a rental-backed security, which means that when we as ordinary people rent from a Blackstone home, the company is going to bundle our rental payments and sell them off as a security to investors all around the world. And when they do that, it won't only benefit Blackstone, it will also make money for Deutsche Bank and make money for J.P. Morgan Chase, and it'll make money for all of Blackstone's institutional owners. And you guessed it, yes, those are all of the major banks that crashed the economy in the first place.
This gives new meaning to the term cartel.
I think that it's very clear that we're living in a corporate cartel environment in the sense that, you know, we are looking at a scenario in which the assets in this country, and I hate to use the word assets because I think we really need to start redefining what homes mean and how they're valued, but if we live in an environment in which they're defined as assets, then we need to see that the majority of these assets and the majority of the wealth and the majority, therefore, of the legislative control is all tied up in Wall Street. And so whether it's J.P. Morgan Chase or it's Blackstone, you can see that they're working together and they're both working against the interests of the American public.
This massive capital intervention in the housing market is so large, only a sovereign government could match it. Doesn't that seem to cry out for a federal counter-intervention?
Yeah, I think when you start to talk about the issue of the federal government, you have only seen very disappointing interventions from the Obama administration since the beginning of this crisis. And, you know, to be clear, I think that we need more government action, not less. So I'm not trying to slam the government, but the lack of intervention on behalf of ordinary Americans dealing with the housing crisis was staggering. the Obama administration, every single program that the administration unveiled that was supposed to help ordinary Americans seemingly was incapable of dispersing its funds. For example, the HAMP program, the Home Affordable Modification Program, you couldn't even dispense the funds that had been allocated to help ordinary homeowners. We didn't see any type of problem when the Obama administration bailed out the banks. The banks had no problem receiving those trillions of dollars overnight from the federal government. And now, today, what we're seeing, once again, is the Obama administration actually celebrating the housing recovery without scrutinizing who it's a recovery for. And if you start to run the numbers, as I have and as other economists have, you know, and other journalists have, you see that this is not a recovery from ordinary Americans. This is not a recovery for the 99%. This is only a recovery for Wall Street. And it certainly calls for increased federal intervention to stop such a land grab.
Well, maybe the bankers' housing recovery is what the Obama administration is celebrating. It left, as you mentioned, billions of dollars sitting in federal coffers in the HAMP program instead of helping out homeowners. And we have to note that in 2007, 2008, of the remaining presidential candidates, Obama was the only one who refused to endorse even a voluntary moratorium on foreclosures.
Yeah, and I think that you're spot on that. And it's important to say that, you know, in polls in 2009, 2010, the vast majority of ordinary Americans supported a moratorium. And since the Obama administration has been completely unwilling to even entertain serious federal intervention, that's why we really need to start moving towards a people's moratorium to stop evictions, and we need to start moving towards serious community organizing to get players like the Blackstone Group out of our neighborhoods. And so there are dozens, hundreds of community organizations and grassroots movements that are enacting that type of people's moratorium on the ground. They're mobilizing communities, they're stopping evictions, they're taking over bank-owned houses. You know, I've documented a lot of this work, incredible organizing in Chicago, in Atlanta, in LA, in San Francisco. It's starting up in New York, even in parts of North Carolina where all the big banks are based. And so that's the type of work that if we are serious about moving towards a more sane housing policy in this country, we really need to increase and we really need to be supporting.
Well, it looks like housing policy as a political issue is almost a blank slate because the federal government hasn't had a housing policy for a very long time, unless, of course, laissez-faire is the policy.
Yeah, I think the only, you know, serious housing policy discussion that we've had recently is how to privatize Fannie and Freddie. And again, I think that privatizing various aspects of a market that really caters to people's basic human needs is exactly the wrong direction we need to be going. For me, I think the most insidious and scary aspect of this is that the Blackstone Group has unveiled a new type of risky security that's further financializing, further commodifying housing. And so what it did just a few weeks ago was release the first AAA-rated rental-backed security in U.S. history. Now, what does that mean? Because I know it was a lot of jargon. What this means is if somebody lives in a Blackstone-owned home, their rental payment is going to be bundled with the rental payments of thousands of other renters. And that is going to go into a bond that is sold off to investors all around the world. And, you know, what's really important to understand this is who those investors are going to be. And because this has received a AAA rating, but because it's not going to actually yield an incredible return, those investors aren't going to be the Goldman Sachs's of the world. They're going to be pension funds. They're going to be, you know, teachers' retirement funds. They're going to be municipal governments. And so in the future, if we're concerned about the health of our local government, if we're concerned about the health of our teachers' pensions, we need to say they shouldn't be investing in these risky products. And these risky products shouldn't be on the market at all. They should be utterly illegal, and they definitely did not deserve a AAA rating.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.